Part 4. Crusade. Chapter 19. They had made him a giant. Long after he thought he was accustomed to the transformation, Zahariel found that aspects of his altered physiology still had the power to amaze him. It was always the little things that did it. He would become aware of some small detail. He would notice the span of his hand, feel the ripple of psychic energy in his body, or he would hear the rhythm of enhanced blood beating in his chest, and he would be reminded all over again of how much he'd changed. Once he had been human. He had been a man, born of woman. Like all men, he had been constrained by physical limitations he took for granted. His muscles had been weak, his bones brittle, and his senses dull. He had expected his life to last him a matter of 50 or 60 years at most, in all likelihood not even that. On Caliban there were so many dangers. Even the merest cut could become infected and prove to be a fatal wound. He had been only human, and to be human is to be a slave to death by 1,000 insignificant means. The Imperium had changed everything. On the day he had been initiated into the Order as a knight, his rebirth had been an entirely symbolic process. With the arrival of the Imperium, it had become literal and real. He had been made into a new man. His mind and body had both been altered, transformed into something more than human. Through the application of Imperial science and the marvels of gene seed, he had been recast and recreated in a more warlike mould. Brother Israfael had inducted him into the Legion's Librarius, where he had learned of the warp, the hazards and the power that could be wielded by those skilled in such things. He learned that he was such a man, gifted with powers beyond the normal ken of humans, and that he was duty-bound to use his powers in the service of the Emperor. He had taken his first steps along a road that could lead to incredible power, but his first forays into such things were small, and nowhere near as amazing as his encounter with a beast of Endriago. As much as his newfound abilities would forever mark him out as special amongst the Legion, he was, first and foremost, a warrior, and it was in the crucible of combat that he would earn his renown. He was no longer an ordinary man, nor was he simply an extraordinary warrior. The Imperium had made him so much more. They had made him for war. He had become a god of battle, a member of the Astartes. He was a space marine, a dark angel. He served in the Great Crusade. He knew he was a small cog in a grander design, a walk-on part in the great drama of human history, but such notions did not trouble him, for the Imperium was a noble undertaking, a dream of a better universe, and he was part of the martial arm that gave it substance. It was an optimistic time, a time of fine ideals. It was an age of discovery, and he was part of it. The early days were great days, decades of conquest in the name of the Emperor. Afterwards, Zahariel would look back on these years as the happiest of his life. He had a purpose, he had a mission. He was an instrument of the Emperor's will, preparing to wage wars for the betterment of humanity. Nor was he alone in these struggles. He did not do these things on his own. Throughout his transformation from man to superhuman, Nemiel was there beside him. The tale-tellers, selected to accompany them from Caliban, spoke of destiny, and Zahariel could only agree, for it seemed that he and Nemiel were fated to stand shoulder to shoulder throughout life's travails. From their earliest days on Caliban, their lives had always been linked, brothers even before they became angels. If anything, the process of becoming Astartes had only served to strengthen the bond between them. At times, it was as though one complete soul, split by accident of birth, was incarnated into two separate bodies. He and Nemiel continued to complement each other perfectly like pieces of the same puzzle. Zahariel, despite everything, still the idealist, and Nemiel, the impressionable pragmatist. Of the night beneath the circle chamber, neither spoke, understanding that to pick at that old wound would be to open a box of recrimination that could never be closed. It remained an unspoken barb in their friendship, always there between them, though Zahariel's recollections of that night were hazy at best, and faded with every passing day. They had been part of the first generation of Astartes to be recruited from Caliban. More tellingly, they were among the first to wear the Legion's new winged sword insignia at their shoulder, the first to call themselves Dark Angels. Afterwards, this would set them apart from their peers. The older members of the Legion were all men from Terra, who could remember a time before the Emperor's first legion had borne the name Dark Angels, while those that came after Zahariel and Nemiel's generation had never known anything different. For the moment, though, a golden age lay ahead. Their days were brightened by the prospect of fighting at the side of the Lion and Luther. They did their work as newly elevated angels well, assigned to serve in the 22nd chapter under the leadership of Chapter Master Hadariel. They served their legion and the Imperium to the limit of their abilities. Caliban was in the past, and though they loved their homeworld and hoped to see it again one day, it was a distant dream. Their present and their life in the Great Crusade was all that truly mattered. Their first major campaign was a time of great excitement, for this would be their chance to take the light of the Great Crusade to the wider galaxy. Their first chance to prove their devotion and loyalty to the Emperor without another legion breathing down their necks. Dark Angels from the 22nd chapter were to rendezvous with the 4th Imperial Expedition Fleet, currently at high anchor, around a world catalogued as 4-3 in the annals of the Crusade's record keepers. To the planet's inhabitants, an advanced human culture that had managed to survive the long isolation of Old Night with much of their technology and society intact, their world had a different name. They called it Sarosh.
"So, this is it," said Nemiel. "This is the reason we've crossed 10 star systems. It doesn't look like much."
"You should know by now that it doesn't matter what a world looks like," Zahariel told him. "Do you remember training on Helicon 4? I seem to recall you weren't too impressed with those worlds either until the shooting started."
"That was different," shrugged Nemiel. "At least then there was the chance we'd see action. They were new worlds. Have you read the briefing files? They expect us to wait for months, twiddling our thumbs, while some bureaucrat decides whether or not to declare the planet compliant. We're Dark Angels, Zahariel, not guard dogs. We were made for better than this."
They stood by a view portal on the observation deck of the strike cruiser, Wrath of Caliban. Through it, Zahariel could see the planet Sarosh, its size magnified by the enhancement technology cunningly concealed in the transparent substance of the portal window. While Nemiel seemed to regard the blue ball of a world with ill-disguised disdain, its beauty struck Zahariel at once. He saw an expanse of turquoise seas, the broad landmasses of the planet's continents presently hidden beneath a shifting layer of variegated cloud. Set against the black backdrop of space and surrounded by distant shimmering stars, it could almost have been a round, polished gemstone lying on a velvet backcloth amid a scattering of tiny jewels. He had seen many worlds from orbit in his time with the Crusade, but Sarosh was certainly one of the most striking.
"I read the briefings," he said. "According to the reports, extensive areas of the planet are covered in woodland. I like the sound of that. It'll be good to be in the forest again, to visit a world that brings back memories of Caliban."
"To do that, it would have to be full of murderous predators, not to mention lethal plants and fungi," snorted Nemiel. "We've hardly been away for long enough for you to start getting nostalgic about Caliban." "But you weren't listening to what I've been saying about our mission. The point I've been making is that there's no glory in it. They may call the 4th an expedition fleet, but really it's little better than a secondary deployment group. This is what they send in once the fighting is done, and they need someone to see to the clean-up. They don't think we're ready yet."
"I heard you," said Zahariel, "and I understand your point, but I see it differently. Don't take me wrong. I'd like nothing better than orders telling us we're about to be dropped into the middle of a firefight. You said it yourself. We're Dark Angels. We're made for war. But duty comes first, and right now it is our duty to watch over the planet of Sarosh as it is brought to compliance."
"Duty?" said Nemiel, rolling his eyes in sarcasm. "It seems to me we've had this conversation before, about 7 million times at the last count. All right, I concede the point. You're right, and I'm wrong. I'll admit to anything just so long as you don't launch into another long speech about duty. You could bore a man to death on almost any topic under the sun. I heard you delivering some supposedly stirring words to your squad yesterday. I pitied them."
"It's called oratory," Zahariel smiled, recognizing a familiar argument. "Don't you remember what it says in the verbatim? The arts of the warrior include not only the techniques of combat, nor simply the understanding of strategy and tactics, but also the study of every skill that may have bearing on the leadership of men in times of crisis."
"I remember it," said Nemiel, his face growing suddenly stern. "But you need to remember we're no longer in the Order. All that is behind us. Old ways are dead. I'm serious. They died the day the Emperor came to Caliban, and we learned of the lion's true nature. From that moment on, we became dark angels, and we put the past behind us.
Excuse me, honoured masters, a voice interrupted before Zahariel could reply. I hope you will forgive the intrusion.
Turning with Nemiel, Zahariel saw a seneschal standing behind them. The man wore a grey tabard over a black body glove, the tabard marked with the livery of the Dark Angels' Legion. The seneschal dropped to one knee on the deck floor, his head bowed in respect.
Chapter Master Hadariel sends his regards, said the man once Nemiel had given him the sign to speak. He reminds you that the transfer of command will take place on board the flagship Invincible Reason in 2 hours' time. He emphasized that your presence is required at the ceremony and that he expects you will comport yourselves in the best traditions of the Legion.
Our thanks to the Chapter Master, said Nemiel. Assure him we will be there at the transfer, properly dressed as befits the ceremony. We understand the importance of paying full respects to our brother Legion.
The seneschal stood, bowed once more, and withdrew. As the servant walked away, Nemiel turned to Zahariel with a ghost of a smile playing across his features.
It seems the Chapter Master is anxious lest we embarrass him, he said quietly, so the seneschal would not hear it.
I wouldn't take it personally, answered Zahariel. It's difficult for him. He is a great warrior, but he is not true Astartes. Even after all these years, it must be hard to reconcile that fact, especially when we meet our brothers.
True, said Nemiel, as he made a sour face. We can only hope that the White Scars appreciate his efforts.
Zahariel raised his hand in quiet admonition.
Careful.
Remember, our honour is at stake. If you say anything to offend them, it will reflect badly on Hadariel, our chapter, and the Legion. Nemiel shook his head.
You worry too much. I've no intention of offending anyone, especially not the White Scars. They are our brothers, and I have nothing but respect for them. Anyway, they had the right idea in leaving this planet and heading out to find real action. If I have cause for annoyance, it's that someone chose us to take up their duties as guard dogs in their stead.
Chapter Master Hadariel had briefed his senior officers around the wide table of the Strategium on board the Wrath of Caliban nearly 3 weeks earlier.
We have received new orders, he had said. We are to split our strength. A portion of the Legion is to continue on to Phaonis, while the rest will go ahead to relieve the White Scars at a planet called Sarosh.
So, an emergency call for aid, then? Asked Damas.
Always inclined to open his mouth before he thought things through, Company Master Damas was the first to speak.
Our brother Astartes have bitten off more than they can chew, eh?
No,
said Hadariel, his face like a mask, betraying no sign of emotion.
From all accounts, the situation at Sarosh is peaceful. It is more a matter of the redisposition of forces. We are being sent to Sarosh to enable the White Scars to be moved on to duties elsewhere in the galaxy. They are a young and impetuous legion, and their Primarch still craves the thrill of the hunt.
It was Nemiel who gave voice to the question, forming in the others' minds.
Forgive me, Chapter Master, but it sounds like you're saying the White Scars are judged more important to the Crusade than the Dark Angels, that we're being shunted sideways to a quiet posting just so the Great Khan's followers will be free to find a real war.
True to form, Damas jumped to conclusions.
The lion would never agree to this.
Hadariel slapped his open palm down on the table, the noise like a gunshot.
Silence! You speak out of turn, Master Damas. You show yourself too full of choler. One more outburst and I will relieve you of duty. Perhaps a few days' meditation would restore the balance of your humours.
My apologies, Chapter Master, said Damas, bowing his head. I was in error.
Indeed you were. And what of you, Brother Nemiel?
The Chapter Master's eyes turned like a laser.
I would have thought you would know better. If I want your opinion on any subject, particularly as regards the interpretation of orders, I will ask for it. Is that understood?
Perfectly, Chapter Master,
bowed Nemiel in a more grudging fashion.
Good, nodded Hadariel. As Damas says, you are both in error, probably more so than you realize. Our orders are from the Lion and Luther, and if our leaders tell us we can serve them best by travelling to Sarosh, we do not argue.
This is a weighty duty, said Shen Khan, the ranking leader among the White Scars. There is no glory in it, and no Astartes would gladly seek out this task. It is an onerous chore thrust upon us. There is no battle to be won here, or at least not any battle of the kind we were made for. And without battle, we lack all purpose. We are bereft. We are incomplete.
Shen Khan stood facing the lion on the observation deck of the battle barge Invincible Reason, flagship of the 4th Imperial Expedition Fleet. Luther and a white scar named Kyrgis stood on either side of them as witnesses to the ceremony, while Astartes from both legions, as well as a delegation of senior officers and dignitaries from various arms of the fleet, watched the exchange from a respectful distance. Zahariel watched with Nemiel as the solemn ceremony of welcome played out the last of its rites, and their legion accepted the task of maintaining law and order on Sarosh.
"Such is the way with duty," continued Shen Khan. "It weighs down on our shoulders, but we feel its weight more keenly in our souls. Brother, do you accept this burden?"
The white scar held out an ornate brass cylinder with a scroll rolled inside it.
"I accept it," replied the lion. He held out his hand and took the cylinder. "By my life and by the lives of my men, I swear to do honour in this matter by my legion and the emperor. Let these words be witnessed."
"They are witnessed," said Zahariel and his white scar counterpart in unison.
"It is good," nodded Shen Khan.
The white scar crossed his arms across his chest in the sign of the Aquila, saluting Zahariel and his chapter master.
"You are well met, Lion L. Johnson of the Dark Angels. On behalf of the White Scar's Legion, I bid you welcome to Sarosh."
They called it a ceremony, but it hardly merited the title. To mark the transfer of command of the 4th Imperial Expedition Fleet from the White Scars to the Dark Angels, a scroll was passed from hand to hand, and an oath was made. If anything, meagre as they were, the trappings of ceremony attached to the event outweighed the substance of the transfer itself. The 4th was one of the smaller expedition fleets of the Great Crusade, incorporating 7 vessels in total. The flagship, Invincible Reason, the troopships, Noble Sinew and Bold Conveyor, the frigates, Intrepid and Dauntless, the destroyer, Arbalest, and the White Scar strike cruiser, Swift Horseman, soon to be replaced by the Dark Angel's ship, Wrath of Caliban. The handover of control between the two legions had been carried out with due respect and reverence, but in reality, the fact that there was an Astartes contingent present at all was something of an anomaly. Strictly speaking, the 4th was still a second-line fleet, lacking the firepower, training, or resources to mount a full-scale military campaign against a hostile world. Its job was to oversee the transition to compliance among worlds that had already shown they were friendly to the Imperium's aims. With Sarosh, however, there had been problems. Initial contact with the planet had been made nearly a year earlier, and on the surface its people were friendly. They had welcomed the Imperium with open arms, loudly proclaiming their willingness to accept the Imperial truth. Yet in the 12 months since, little or no progress had been made in bringing the planet to compliance. There had been no violence and no outright acts of resistance, but each of the procedures embarked upon by Imperial envoys to effect compliance had so far ended in abject failure. Each time a new initiative was launched, the Saroshi government promised to do everything in their power to ensure it would be a success, and each time the promised support had failed to materialize. The government would make fulsome apologies, they would make excuses, citing misunderstandings caused by the differences in customs and language as the reason behind the impasse. They would blame the intransigence of their own bureaucracy, claiming 5,000 years of stable, ordered society had left them with a bureaucratic system that was both enormously top-heavy and remarkably complex. Certainly there seemed to be some truth in their claims. Experienced Imperial envoys, who had overseen the compliance of many worlds in their time, would shake their heads in despair whenever the vexing question of the Saroshi bureaucracy was raised. The problem was that the bureaucrats of Sarosh were part-timers. The planet's laws allowed its citizens to set aside a generous part of their tax burden by agreeing to spend a proportion of their time working as bureaucrats. Accordingly, the latest planetary census, compiled at 3 monthly intervals on Sarosh, indicated that 25% of the adult population held some form of bureaucratic position, with the remainder comprising those who had failed to pass the planet's exacting examination of basic bureaucratic proficiency. Based on the same census data, that meant that there were currently more than 180 million bureaucrats working on Sarosh. With so many bureaucrats taking part in the process, Imperial envoys had found it almost impossible to get things done. It did not matter whether the planet's government agreed to a measure. For it to be put into practice, it still had to navigate the apparently endless levels of local bureaucracy, including various pardoners, petitioners, notaries, exemptors, signatories, exegetists, resolutionists, codifiers, prescriptors, and agents proxy. Worse, the system had grown so complicated in the course of the last 5 millennia, it was often the case that even the bureaucrats had no idea how to make it work. By common opinion amongst most of those charged with ensuring Sarosh was brought to compliance, in the last 12 months, they had achieved almost nothing in the way of real progress. The planet was still as far from true compliance as it had been on the day it was first discovered. The Swift Horseman had lain at high anchor above the planet through the entire process, as the fleet's envoys struggled to make sense of Sarosh's bureaucratic labyrinth. It was a hangover from the planet's initial discovery, left behind in the hope that the presence of the Astartes might focus the minds of the Saroshi leaders and encourage them to complete the process of compliance quickly. Instead, for 12 months, the White Scars had found they had to endure an extended period of enforced idleness. It had not sat well with them. The fleet's senior commanders had grown to dread the weekly strategic briefings when Sheng Khan would demand to know how much longer he and his men were to be expected to sit in space doing nothing. The White Scar's leader seemed to reserve special contempt for Lord Governor-elect Harlard I, the man assigned to oversee the Sarosh territories in the name of the Emperor once they were compliant.
"If these people are compliant, then certify that compliance so we can leave this place!"
Sheng Khan was heard to roar at the governor-elect on more than one occasion.
"If they are not compliant, tell me and we will go to war to show them their folly. You may choose it either way, just so long as you make a damn decision."
In truth, Lord First and his functionaries had not made the decision. In a bureaucratic masterstroke, they had continually put off reaching any final judgment, utilizing every excuse at their disposal in an attempt to delay the matter indefinitely, in precisely the kind of maneuvering that often caused the Astartes to look with such disfavor on the growing non-military element accompanying the crusade. In such a way, 12 months had passed unproductively, while the White Scars had grown ever more frustrated, until at last a signal was sent to Lionel Johnson requesting that he and his Dark Angels be assigned to stand watch over Sarosh for an interval of 2 months, to allow the White Scars to be moved on to other duties. Meanwhile, a message was received by Lord Governor-elect First, pointedly reminding him that the 4th Imperial Expedition Fleet was needed elsewhere and could not be expected to stay in orbit around Sarosh forever. The message instructed First that he had been granted a period of grace. He had 2 months to decide the question of the planet's compliance one way or another. If he failed to resolve the matter in that time, he would be stripped of his governorship, and it would fall to Lionel Johnson to decide the fate of Sarosh as he saw fit. Later, once the ceremony was over, it came time for the inevitable social formalities. The Astartes and the assorted dignitaries began to mingle and talk, as attendants in fleet livery circulated amongst them, bearing silver trays overburdened with wine and food. Always uncomfortable in such gatherings, Zahariel did his best to merge with the background. Before long, he was standing beside the wide vista of a panoramic view portal, staring out at Sarosh, slowly turning in the void, much as he had been a few hours earlier when he had stood with Nemiel on the Wrath of Caliban. Perhaps it spoke volumes of the peculiarities of the Dark Angel's mindset, but at that moment he was struck most by how much larger the observation deck on the Invincible Reason was compared to the one on the Wrath of Caliban. Influenced in part by the monastic traditions of the Order, the Dark Angels tended to a Spartan austerity in their ways. Every centimetre of space on a Dark Angel's vessel was at a premium. From the fire control room overseeing operations of the ship's main batteries, to the practice cages where the Astartes honed their skills, everything served a warlike purpose. In contrast, the interior of this ship put Zahariel more in mind of a nobleman's palace than it did a warship. He supposed there was an argument to be made that a ship should be decorated in keeping with the scope and wondrousness of the Imperium, yet to his eyes, to have layers of ornamentation choking almost every inner surface of the ship seemed overly elaborate even ostentatious on a vessel made for war. Naturally, the Dark Angel's ships had their own share of decoration in an understated style, but the doors, walls, and ceilings of the Invincible Reason were cluttered with gilded excesses. If a room was a conversation between the architect who built it and the people who made use of it, this observation deck was currently shouting in a dozen competing and raucous voices. The deck was vast, with an immense vaulted ceiling reminiscent of the great ruined cathedrals of ancient Caliban. One entire wall was dominated by the view portal that Zahariel was standing beside. More than 60 meters tall, the portal was composed of a number of tall arched panels, like stained glass windows in some pagan house of worship. It was not so much the view portal itself, but what it represented. The observation deck might be decorated in a manner in keeping with the Imperium's message, with frescoes depicting some of its finest victories, as well as mural portraits of every captain who had commanded the ship in her centuries of service. But equally, it resembled many of the places of idolatry that the people of Caliban had brought to ruin in the planet's earliest age.
"It looks like a Joy Girl's house of business," said a gruff voice behind him, offering a different perspective.
Zahariel's enhanced sense of hearing had warned him of the approach of a brother Astartes. He turned and saw Kyrgyz facing him, two goblets of wine held dwarfed like thimbles in the White Scar's hands.
"I'm sorry. I don't follow you, brother."
"This place," Kyrgyz inclined his head, indicating the grand sweep of the observation deck around them. "I was saying I think the same of it as you do, brother. There is too much glitter about it, too much that is golden. It is like the Joy Girl palaces in the cities of the Palatine, not a ship for warriors."
"Am I so transparent?" asked Zahariel. "How could you know what I was thinking? Are you one of your legion's librarians?"
"No," said Kyrgyz. "I'm no psyker. Some men are gifted when it comes to hiding their thoughts from others. You could watch their faces for 1,000 years and you'd never know what they were thinking. Not you. I saw the sour look you gave this place as you glanced around. From that, I could guess what was in your mind."
"It was an accurate guess," conceded Zahariel.
"It helped that I could recognize the emotion. My thoughts were identical to yours on seeing this place. But enough of this. I have brought you a drink. When brothers meet, it is good they share wine and make a drinking oath."
Kyrgyz offered him one of the goblets, lifting the other up in a toast.
"To the Dark Angels," said Kyrgyz, "and to the Primarch Lion L. Johnson."
"To the White Scars," answered Zahariel, holding up his own goblet, "and to the Primarch, Chagatai Khan."
They drained the goblets, and once he had finished his drink, Kyrgyz threw the goblet against a wall. The sound of the sharp crack as the metal cup shattered was greeted with a start by some of the dignitaries standing nearby.
"It is tradition," explained the White Scar. "For the words of a drinking oath to have value, you must break the cup so no one else can swear an oath on it."
He nodded in approval as Zahariel followed his example, shattering his goblet against the same wall.
"You are well met, brother. I wanted to talk to you, because we owe you our thanks."
"Thanks," said Zahariel. "How so?"
Kyrgyz indicated some of the other White Scars around the room.
"You have set us free, you and your brothers. I am only sorry that such noble warriors must take up our former position, keeping lonely watch over this miserable dung heap of a world."
"We were happy to accept the assignment with good grace," said Zahariel. "It is a matter of duty."
"Yes, it is duty," said Kyrgyz, lifting a questioning eyebrow,
an expression that emphasized the network of thin honor scars crisscrossing his cheeks.
"But you are being diplomatic, brother. I know it. I am sure dissenting voices were raised when you received your orders. The Dark Angels are too brave and resolute a legion to accept such a command quietly. As Sheng Khan said, it is a weighty duty and a hard one for Astartes to bear. We are warriors, all of us, the Emperor's finest. We should be roaming the galaxy, making war on our enemies. Instead, we find ourselves forced to act as guard dogs."
He stopped speaking abruptly and stared at Zahariel closely.
"What is it?"
the White Scar asked.
"You are smiling. I have said something funny?"
Zahariel shook his head. "Not funny, no. It's just that your words reminded me of something a friend said earlier. He also said we were being treated like guard dogs."
"He did. He is an intelligent man, this friend of yours.
Gurgis turned to look back at the wider room around them.
You have brought a great many warriors with you, I understand. I only ask because I was surprised to see that your squads were led by your chapter master.
We are led by the Lion and Luther, said Zahariel.
I know, but your Lion officer is Sahadariel, is it not?
Following the direction of the other man's gaze, Zahariel looked towards where Chapter Master Hadariel stood talking to Shen Khan and some officers of the fleet. Sheng and the warriors of his bodyguard were much taller than the Dark Angel's Chapter Master, towering over him almost as much as Hadariel towered in his power armor over the ordinary human beings around him. Zahariel noticed that Hadariel was gesturing with his hands as he spoke, making large movements as though in an attempt to demonstrate that he was not intimidated by the White Scar's physical presence. It was a scene Zahariel had observed many times before, and he was not sure Hadariel was even aware he was doing it. Not for the first time, he felt a surge of sympathy for his chapter master. In the time before the Emperor came to Caliban, Hadariel had been considered one of the most able battle knights in the Order. Zahariel remembered serving under him when they had made the final assault on the fortress of the Knights of Lupus. It had been a good victory, an important one in the history of Caliban, but the coming of the Imperium had been a mixed blessing for Hadariel. He had been chosen to join the Dark Angels Legion by the Astartes, but in common with a large proportion of that initial intake, he had been too old to benefit from the implantation of gene seed. In its place, Hadariel and others like him, including Luther, had undergone an extensive series of surgical and chemical procedures designed to raise their strength, stamina, and reflexes to superhuman levels. They were taller, stronger, and quicker than normal men. But for all that, they were not Astartes. They never could be.
"It must be hard to be a man like Hadariel," said Kyrgyz.
"Yes," agreed Zahariel. "My commander is an exemplary warrior. Despite not possessing the gifts of a true Astartes, he has climbed far in the Legion."
"The Lion favors him from the old days?"
Zahariel shook his head. "The Lion does not play favorites. Hadariel became a chapter master purely on merit. If there is an element of sorrow to the situation, it is that Hadariel has never seemed suited to the office."
"What do you mean?"
Zahariel wasn't sure how much to say, for Kyrgyz was of a different legion to his own, and the Dark Angels valued their privacy, yet he sensed that the White Scar was a warrior he could trust. "In the years since his elevation, the mantle of leadership has sat poorly on Hadariel's shoulders. He clashes repeatedly with his officers and fellow chapter masters, and has a tendency to take issue with every imagined slight, as if he's convinced he's being subtly snubbed and insulted by all those around him."
"I suspect it boils down to the fact that Hadariel has never received gene seed."
"Perhaps," agreed Zahariel. "Or perhaps his rise up the ranks has been fueled as much by a desire to prove himself as by his devotion to the Imperial ideal." Zahariel did not add that rumour had it that the Lion had spoken with him sternly on the matter of his fractiousness. No matter his successes, it appeared that Hadariel could not escape his inner conviction that he was being looked down upon because he was not full Astartes. "It has always been Chapter Master Hadariel's way to take the lead whenever our chapter is sent to a new theatre of operations," said Zahariel. "He likes to be able to see things for himself."
"A wise practice," nodded Kyrgyz.
Kyrgyz glanced back towards the view of Sarosh through the portal, holding his gaze on the planet for long seconds, as though weighing the words he was about to say.
"Don't trust them," said the White Scar.
"Who?"
"The people of Sarosh," Kyrgyz replied.
He faced more fully towards the view portal and indicated the planet.
"You haven't met them yet, brother, so I thought I should warn you. Don't trust them, and don't turn your back on them."
"I thought they were peaceful. According to the briefings, they've been welcoming from the first."
"They have been," agreed Kyrgyz. "But still, I would not trust them, not if you have sense, brother. And don't trust the briefings. Lord Governor-elect First and his cronies have too much influence on what is written within them."
He turned momentarily to grimace towards a silver-haired, medal-festooned dignitary holding court among a sea of sycophants off to the side of the deck.
"That is the Lord Governor-elect?" asked Zahariel.
"In his day he was a great general," shrugged Kyrgyz. "Or so they say. It happens sometimes. A man is made chieftain, and soon all that is important to him is his status. He becomes deaf to any voice that doesn't try to soothe and cosset him. Before long, he only listens to those who tell him what he wants to hear.
And that is what is happening on Sarosh?
Without a doubt, said Kyrgis, pursing his lips in frustration. If First had any sense, he'd ask himself why the Saroshi are stalling. If they truly wished to be part of the Imperium as they claim, you'd think they would be ready to move the very stars to satisfy our requirements. Instead, there are always more delays, more intransigence. Don't misunderstand me. They are unfailingly polite, the Saroshi. Whenever a new problem arises with the compliance process, they throw their hands in the air and wail like women mourning an elder's death. To listen to them, you'd think it was all accidents and bad luck. That is why I say don't trust them. Either they are intentionally putting off compliance, or they are the unluckiest people in the galaxy. And I don't know about you, brother, but I don't believe in luck, neither good nor bad.
I agree, said Zahariel. He scanned the crowd of figures spread throughout the observation deck for unfamiliar uniforms. I don't see any Saroshi at this gathering.
You'll see them tomorrow, Kyrgis told him. A celebration is planned. The Saroshi intend to welcome your arrival on their world exactly as they welcomed our arrival a year ago. There will be a feast, entertainments and the like, both here on the Invincible Reason and down below on Sarosh. I am sure it will be convivial. No doubt the Saroshi leaders will make many great promises. You will hear them tell you that compliance is just around the corner. They will say they are working night and day to achieve the tasks the Imperium has set them. They will talk fulsomely of their newfound devotion to the Imperial cause, of how happy they are that you have come to rescue them from their ignorance. Do not believe it, brother. I have always held that the true worth of a man is demonstrated by his actions, not his words. So far, by that mark, the Saroshi appear to possess no worth at all.
You suspect their motives, then? Asked Zahariel. Do you think the Saroshi are delaying compliance for a reason?
I don't know. There is a saying on my homeworld, if a man follows wolf tracks, it is likely he will find a wolf. But I cannot offer you proof of my suspicions, brother. I simply thought I should warn you in the spirit of comradeship. Be wary of these people. Do not trust them. Soon enough, the White Scars will be gone from this place. Sheng Khan has already ordered preparations to be made for us to get underway and head to our new duties. The Swift Horseman is to leave this system in 4 hours.
Kyrgis smiled, though there was no humour to it.
After that, you are on your own.